call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water for Tuesday, April 21st. And we are going to begin with some work sessions. So members of the public who are here to for one of our public hearings, you'll get to see your legislature at work for a few minutes before we move into public hearing. And we're going to start, because Representative Tomei is here, we're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2676. And members, I'll just bring to your attention, we're still awaiting a fiscal statement on this. So Representative Tomei is here to tell us again, remind us what the bill is about, draw our attention to the amendment. We could even adopt the amendment, but we cannot yet move the bill. We may be able to do that later this hour, but not presently, unless it's there.
Is that it? Yeah. Wow.
Great. Oh, good timing.
Good.
Great.
Timing.
Great.
She's very powerful.
Mr. Chair and committee, again, my name is Carolyn Tomei. I'm state representative in House District 41. I have a very simple bill in front of you today, House Bill 2676, and we had a hearing, I think, a week or two ago. This is a very simple bill that requires people who smoke either cigars or cigarettes to dispose of them in a friendly way. And there is an amendment that makes this, instead of a Class B violation, it would be a Class D violation, which would mean that it would be at most a $90 fine, and people that could also perform community service instead of paying a fine. And colleagues, I'm going to pass, if I may, Mr. Chair, pass these around, and I'd like to have them back.
Maybe. Do you want to give him to Sue?
These are little places where you can dispose of your cigarette butt, and they fit inside the pack of cigarettes. They even have a nice American flag on them, and they say, "Keep America litter-free for considerate, non-littering smokers." Isn't that wonderful? I love this. So I'm open for any questions.
So, Representative, if the smoker then throws these away, are they subject
That's
to...
That's what I was going to ask.
they can't throw them on. They have to dispose of them in a responsible way.
Okay.
In a trash container.
Good. Are there any questions for Representative Tomei?
Would this provide a safe harbor? if I were to insert it within this thing, and then would that be all right?
A safe harbor? Oh, yes.
Okay, but I'd still have to put it in the wastebasket.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Otherwise be subject, I think, to littering laws.
Actually, I apologize for this absurd question, Mr. Chair.
You're on judiciary. You do this kind of thing. Go ahead.
We talk about this thing all the time. So if I put my cigarette butt in here and I enclose it, and I put it on the ground, is it a cigarette butt or is it a piece of litter?
Oh, I'm not the attorney here, Representative Smith.
Here.
So I may be asking the question to myself, but I'm now nervous. All right.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a really considerate piece of litter now.
All right, we can leave that.
Thank you. Any further questions for Representative Tomei? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
And I would accept a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4/15/09.
Representative Smith moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4/15/09. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. And Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2676 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
And Representative Smith moves House Bill 2676 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pence.
With the greatest respect for my colleague and friend, I will be voting no on this bill. It seems to me that the bill may make a great deal of sense for cities like Portland, Salem, and places where there are lots of smokers. It makes very little sense for places like I represent. Not to suggest that my 26,000 square mile district should be littered with cigarette butts, but it's not the largest problem that we face. It may be a much bigger problem in areas where there are lots and lots and lots of cigarette butts, which may be the case in these cities, but that is not the case in my district. And also, there is a situation or a level of regulation that we should be engaging in in at least my district, and this, although with the greatest of good feelings, is not the kind of bill I can support. Wish I could. I can't.
Thank you for those comments. Any additional discussion? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm thinking maybe it'll help you to change your mind. If you think of it as once it's in there, it probably couldn't start a fire because it looks like it's metal or foil. And so you would alleviate a prairie fire. I would alleviate a forest fire.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bennett.
The risk of being too flippant, I will say that about the only thing we have left to do in many parts of Eastern Oregon is fight fire because we aren't allowed into the forest for many other reasons. And so not that I would suggest anyone should start one or that I would hope anyone would start one with a cigarette. It is unfortunate that much of the use in our part of the state is now restricted to fighting fire. Kind of sad. But that won't change my vote.
Okay.
Any right. Further discussion? Seeing none, Sue, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Bent.
No.
Representative
Boone.
Aye. Representative Jensen.
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Chair Kent.
Aye. And the motion passes. Representative Tomei, will you carry this bill to the floor, please? Very good.
Thank you.
And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2676 and open up a work session on House Bill 2539 and ask Representative Shields to tell us, remind us of this bill and any work that we may need to do on it today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members for the committee. Just briefly, you have the dash ones in front of you. I suggest you move the dash ones that line up the window for purchasing with the window for use of fireworks and send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation. The main reason I'm here is to put on the record as a courtesy that although the fireworks industry or one company that has some concerns about this bill.
Representative Shields, would you identify yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry, Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I just want to let you all know that there is a fireworks company that has agreed to this for to let it go on this side without any type of contention, but we both agreed to continue negotiations on the Senate, and I just wanted to get put that on the record that there were still some concerns to be ironed out, and just because they have not called on you to express their concerns doesn't mean those concerns don't exist.
Appreciate that courtesy. Is it still the case under the Dash 1 amendments that this would only apply to cities with a population of 300,000 or more?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so only applies to Portland. And the other thing that the Dash 1 amendments do is clarify that the period during which it would be eligible, that one could sell these fireworks matches the period in which they're eligible to be used.
That's correct, in June 30th to July 5th.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Shields? So I will take a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/11/09.
Representative Smith moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/11/09. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2539 as amended to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2539 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's very appropriate that our largest city would act as a guinea pig for this important matter and that they be allowed to run a pilot project to determine whether this would be an appropriate law for the rest of the state. I hope that pilot project won't last too long and that the rest of us will have the opportunity to benefit from the peace, the quiet, and tranquility that this bill will bring to Portland. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Any further discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And before you do, sorry, members of the audience, remind you, the buzzing in the system is from communication devices, cell phones, pagers, Blackberries, turn them off. We've done that to ours, I hope. Go ahead, Representative Goody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't doubt the motivation of my friend from the soul of Portland, and so I say this also with great respect, but Representative Barnhart's reasons are pretty much my reasons for opposing the bill. It's beyond me that we're running a pilot program using Portland for the rest of the state, and it's one of my concerns, is that this is more than an issue for Portland. It is the beginning of an issue for the whole state, and I fail to see how it rises to the level of legislation in this particular cycle of the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Any further discussion on House Bill 2539, Representative Jensen? We're in work session on 2539. There is a motion before us to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This is the bill that would limit the use of fireworks within cities greater than 300,000. Any further discussion? If not, Sue, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Mintz.
No.
Representative Bloom.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bloom. Chair Cannon.
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Shields, I assume you will carry this to the floor. Thank you. And with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2539. A couple of announcements. We will not be working House Bill 2859, members. The relating clause on this bill, this was the water bill, it's at the top of your agendas, meant that any work we did on this bill had to relate just to those domestic exempt wells. And as I think we heard from the department last week, that creates challenges administratively. It may create challenges politically as well. So we will not be working House Bill 2859. You will not see it on a future agenda. I will be carrying over House Bill 3090, so we will not be discussing that today, but we may discuss it on Thursday or Tuesday of next week. And we will here next. Let's see. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3463 and ask Representative Bailey to talk about the amendments. We don't have the paperwork in place in this bill, so we will not be moving this bill today. However, we could take a motion on the amendment. Before we do that, I'm going to ask Representative Bailey to talk, as he did last week, a little about the work that he and Representative Jensen have done on this bill. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Jensen can jump in when if I get anything wrong here. As we discussed last week, House Bill 3463, we engaged with the stakeholders on that bill, primarily related to two particular issues. One, the date in which the bill takes effect, and two, the inclusion or exclusion of renewable diesel. We reached an agreement on the date of the bill for when the bill takes effect, and essentially with some notification provisions in the majority of the Willamette Valley and Clatsop County and Columbia County, it takes effect on August 1st in the Dash 6s, and in the rest of the state, it takes effect on October 1st. With regards to the new renewable diesel, there was less of an agreement. We had heard from those in the industry, in the petroleum industry, that renewable diesel was not currently being used, and given the contentious nature of both sides on renewable diesel, we made a decision that it seemed fair to both sides to ask for a 2-year moratorium on renewable diesel to give the technology a chance to develop and for us to be able to make an assessment of how well it's working, the existing system is working, before it is integrated. So unless the legislature acts otherwise, after 2 years, the renewable diesel provisions will kick back in to the bill. And that's essentially where we ended up, Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen, did I get that correct?
I think that's good. Yes.
Are there any questions for Representative Bailey? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the difference between the two, the renewable diesel on the one hand and the biodiesel on the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, without being glib, one likes it, one doesn't. And there was, I would say that the proponents of the bill, as was originally in the bill, wanted renewable diesel excluded altogether. And that was how the original bill was written. Those in the renewable diesel industry and the petroleum industry felt that it was had the potential to be a viable technology in the future. And in the interest of allowing for that development to happen, we made a decision that it made sense to have a moratorium on that process since it's not being used anyway currently, and there will be a lag until it is market ready to reach a point where we could get to a point where we've got this bill moving forward, and then in 2 years it will come back in unless the legislature decides to do otherwise. So we thought this was a compromised position, even though neither side was very happy with it.
So the very definition of compromise, neither side being happy. Representative Jensen.
I think one of the other parts that might be pointed out here, at the present time, there isn't any production of the renewable diesel, so it's really not taking anything, barring anything at the present time, from the market when there's none being produced.
Representative Benz.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I must confess, I do not know much about this at all, so forgive me if I misstate what I do understand. I thought that renewable diesel was similar in nature, and there is it is available, but it's not available inside the state of Oregon. It has to be imported in, whereas biodiesel is actually being or could be produced in state. So am I correct in thinking that renewable diesel, the main difference is that it's produced out of state and can be then imported, and biodiesel is already being produced in state and is already here? Or am I misunderstanding that?
Do you want to take a stab at that?
Can we ask Brian Doherty?
Sure.
Answer that question.
Brian here? Yeah.
Make sure we don't have the wrong information.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Brian Doherty here on testifying on behalf of the Western State Petroleum Association. Renewable diesel has been tested and proven to meet ASTM standards. It has not been marketed or blended, manufactured in the Northwest as of yet, but it is a viable product that has been tested and has been used in other states. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Thanks. I think it's pretty clear that the intent of the authors of this bill was to make it as likely as possible that we would meet this B2 mandate using biodiesel produced in-state. That was certainly a big part of the motivation behind the renewable fuel standard that we passed last session, the economic development that occurs as a result of in-state production of biodiesel and ethanol. And one of the ways that I think they're trying to meet that, or trying to increase that likelihood, is there's nothing in this bill, I don't think, that requires that the biodiesel come from in-state. But one of the ways they're trying to get there is by saying, well, none of this renewable diesel, which isn't being produced in-state. I think that's, if I can try to speak for the kind of architects of the bill, that was their intent. Are there other questions for Representative Bailey or Jensen or Mr. Doherty, since we have him here? Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to catch up. I may have missed some of the conversation about this bill during the time that I was battling all the various bugs that we had during the winter here. I've looked at the definition of biodiesel in the bill, and I've looked at the definition of other renewable diesel, and it looks like the difference is palm oil.
What have I missed?
If you're asking me, Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart, palm oil isn't a difference. It's two different manufacturing processes. One is in transesterification, a chemical process, which is what B100 biodiesel is. The other is a manufacturing process at the refinery on its own that makes what's called renewable diesel, and it actually, you blend at the refinery with diesel, and it makes diesel out of this same bioproduct. So you have the same type of non-fossil fuel renewable products that can either go to a B100 process, biodiesel process, or go to a renewable diesel process. It's two different ways to make a blended diesel product that uses non-fossil fuel sources.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If, Shorty, if our goal is to enhance and protect and encourage our state of Oregon biodiesel folks, is this bill getting that done? Will this bill advance their interests?
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, this bill, what we have agreed to do is to get the B2 biodiesel rolling in Oregon by August 1 and October 1 throughout the state. That will triple the amount of biodiesel that is going on, either double to triple the amount of biodiesel that is being sold currently. The continuation of the renewable diesel definition, which is what I'm urging the committee to do, hasn't affected them since it's been in place since 2007, and it may or may not come in play before 2012. This is a 2.5-year moratorium, by the way. So I don't know when it may come into play that renewable diesel may come in, but I don't know why we take this environmental step backwards and say we're not going to allow people to innovate when we've been asking them to innovate, to come up with ideas to meet non-fossil fuel renewable fuels, and then you say, oh, but we're going to pick winners and losers in this, and we're going to start choosing things and protect competition. I think it's a protectionist legislation that hasn't proved to affect them yet, and no, I don't think it will affect them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benz, go ahead.
I just want to make sure I want to make sure I heard you correctly. Are you saying that if we take the renewable prohibition out, that this would, by allowing it to come into the state, that would not damage the biodiesel people here, or what are you saying? I didn't quite.
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, I'm saying that to this date, we've had other renewable diesel on the books as allowed, and it hasn't come in. And what you've heard is they're having a problem right now that has nothing to do with other renewable diesel because it's never been a competitor in the market. So what I heard them say is they need the mandate for biodiesel now. I don't blame them for asking for this also, but it hasn't been a factor that's led them to this point where they say the tanks are all full and they can't get any sales because it's not a competitor now. So I can understand why they'd like to get rid of a possible competitor, but I don't understand why we would encourage that when we should be encouraging innovation and options to reach consumer choices.
See if I can shed some light on this. Is any renewable diesel being produced in Oregon currently?
No.
Is it foreseeable in the next several years that renewable diesel would be produced in Oregon?
It could be. There's two different processes. The ones that would do from the refineries is one way. There's another one by a company called Neste, who's not a client of mine, that actually can build refineries. There's many ways to do this. It is in its, they are working through it, but it has been defined. Renewable diesel has been defined by the EPA, the IRS, the Energy Security Act, the state of California, and it just passed unanimously in Washington. So they've all adopted rules for renewable diesel. It has to meet standards. It has met standards that are ASTM standards. So it's out here, and we're going to say, wait a minute, we're going to back up.
If I wanted to go out and get my renewable diesel, could I find it in the state of Oregon?
I don't know. I don't think you could at this time from the companies that I represent.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that again, the intention here, and I'm personally somewhat ambivalent about it, but I think that the intention is to maximize the likelihood that we meet this standard by purchasing Oregon-grown biodiesel. There's nothing about this bill that can guarantee that, but allowing renewable diesel to meet that B2 standard would give the distributors options of purchasing renewable diesel from elsewhere in the country, given that it seems unlikely to be developed in Oregon. I believe, is the intention of this bill, and certainly is consistent with the intention of the renewable fuel standard that we passed last session. It was about trying to build in-state capacity for the development of these products. So,
Chair Kaler, just to add on to that statement, it's also just a timeout to allow the technology to be able to develop and for innovation to happen outside of Oregon while we move ahead with this bill and in the interim. And as I said, it's a compromise measure.
Yeah. Representative Vincent.
Yes, I don't fully understand and appreciate Mr. Daugherty's statements and position on this. And I would suggest, however, that when we had the other side in my office, that they were equally adamant about not having renewable diesel in there. And so the representative and I, trying to really reach some sort of a compromise position on this and being fundamentally unable to, chose to try to split the baby in half. Is that a good policy or is that a bad policy? You know, maybe time will tell us one way or the other. I don't know, but that's basically what we did. I believe
that's exactly right.
I think we've had some discussion on this. I would accept a motion on the -6 amendments. We can talk about it more after we get that motion on the table. Again, we can't move the bill, so you will not be asked today to vote yes or no on the bill, but there was some interest in getting the amendment in the bill, and I would accept a motion. Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the -6 amendment dated 4-2109 to House Bill 3463.
Representative Bailey moves the -6 amendment to House Bill 3463 dated 4-2109. Any further discussion of the -6? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the -6s are incorporated into House Bill 3463. We will carry over this work session to Thursday. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3463. Let's go ahead and finish off our work sessions for the day by opening up House Bill 2795. So this is a work session on House Bill 2795. And Beth, do we have what we need on this bill?
Yes. You should have in front of you a -1 amendment. And there's also a fiscal statement and a no revenue statement.
Okay. And Andrea or Tricia, do you want to come up? Do we have any new news on this? We had the -1s last time we heard the bill, didn't we?
Right.
All right. Well, I will accept a motion on the -1 amendments, and then we'll have a chance to discuss and perhaps give folks who haven't looked at this for a week or two a chance to look at it again. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 4309.
Representative Smith moves the -1 amendments dated 4309. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, -1 amendments are incorporated into 2795. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2795 as amended to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2795 as amended to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion, I'll just start by pointing out that the fiscal analysis on this bill is helpful. I think it clarifies that the -1 amendments had their intended effect, which was to ensure that this bill was consistent with the replacement timeline for buses, school buses, that districts already have, and thus the LFO concluded there was no fiscal impact from this bill. Well, indeterminate fiscal impact. But they anticipate that the replacement timeline here will align with the normal replacement schedules already in place. Any further discussion?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Did we hear from school districts? I'm having trouble going back in the memory bank.
We did not. We heard from the Department of Education, Oregon School Employees Association, and the Oregon Environmental Council.
Thank you for the reminder.
Salem Kaiser reports in the fiscal, this shows up in the LFO statement, that there will not be a fiscal impact to exceed the costs associated with normal replacement timeline. So that appears in our fiscal impact statement. Is there further discussion? Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I also have to confess I don't recall the testimony in this bill. Does anyone recall someone testifying the additional safety that children are going to enjoy as a result of the retrofit? Because I don't recall that, and I apologize.
You have a recollection. Yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Yeah, thank you. There was testimony. This is about diesel pollutant, isn't it?
Yep.
There was testimony that indicated that the pollutant inside a bus may be several times the amount of the ambient particulate pollution from diesel being particularly bad because of the 10 microns minus size of the particulate matter and tends to lodge in the lungs at low levels. And that testimony went by fairly quickly, but it was also fairly compelling, as I recall.
Representative Benz?
No, thank you. And thank you for that recollection, Chair Barnhart. For a $7,000 bill per bus, that seems like a relatively small price to pay for that kind of increased safety.
Thank you, Representative Benz. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative
Boone? Aye.
Representative
Jensen. Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gillen.
Aye.
Chair Kent.
Aye. The motion passes, and who would like to carry this bill? I guess my name's on it. I'll carry the bill to the floor. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2795. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3155. We have four folks signed up to testify. I'm not planning on spending very long on this bill. Members will save the balance for House Bill 3249, and we may even get out early, but don't expect that to be the case on Thursday. So let's start Tom O'Connor and Sandy Flicker.
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. And with me is Sandy Flicker with Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We want to start out, first of all, by thanking Representative Boone and the other co-sponsors, including Representative Benz and Representative Jensen, who for working with us to help to design a carbon reduction path for small consumer-owned utilities that we have been working to include into an overall comprehensive climate package bill that's being worked on in the Senate. I'll just summarize, I guess, the written testimony. Consumer-owned utilities in Oregon we are very fortunate to have a very low carbon footprint. We're primarily hydro-based. The benefits of that hydropower come with significant mitigation costs. However, we do have to deal with the fish issues. That adds about 30% to the cost of our wholesale power bill, about 15% at the retail level. We we do have a very small carbon footprint. If you attribute the what are called Bonneville unspecified resources purchases that they use for balancing purposes and to fill in during low water years, those are part of our the way Bonneville operates the system. We don't have any real ability to control those levels. If there was, assuming there is a carbon reduction mandate, the only thing we can really do is buy offsets beyond what we couldn't achieve through energy efficiency and renewables. And therefore, we believe it makes a lot of sense for us to focus on energy efficiency, renewables, and any other carbon reduction strategies that we can work on in our own communities and benefit our own communities rather than, for example, trying to buy trees in some other part of the world, which may have a benefit, but not the kind of benefit, direct benefit that efficiency and renewables would have. The bill itself, just to summarize it, and this proposal, it is designed to create a platform for our utilities to fund carbon reduction. It's specifically it requires and commits our elected boards to establish either a carbon reduction charge of 2% of our retail electric sales revenues, or establish a local conservation and energy efficiency plan to go after cost-effective conservation and efficiency within the service territory. And we listed in the bill a series of specific measures that we believe are important in that overall effort, as well as giving the board the flexibility to respond in the future to things that we, you know, can't anticipate, but that would also reduce reduce our carbon footprint or mitigate our carbon footprint. And want to emphasize that what we're proposing here includes beyond just the traditional energy efficiency, weatherization, low-income weatherization, which are really, you know, the key components to this whole thing. But we also want to be flexible enough to respond with things like efficiency improvements to the distribution system or demand response programs, which the Northwest Power Planning Council in their sixth power plan has shown will be a significant source of emission reductions. Also, what we call vampire loads with consumer electronics that have been a growing part of the increase in electricity loads. So it's designed to be it's a platform, it's a floor on which we can use to establish this charge or program to go after those carbon reductions, those carbon mitigation measures. That being said, I guess since we're here, we do want to caution, and I think you all know that even with the Northwest's long-term focus on conservation and renewables, we are going to need new fossil fuel resources such as natural gas as a bridge to the future and to ensure system reliability to firm and shape those variable renewables. We've got a tremendous amount of wind coming on in the region, for example. In the past, we've used the hydro system to balance out and firm up that wind. The hydro system is maxed out, so we will need, you know, we do have in the future, we're going to have to look at, we want to caution that there will also be a need for some of those balancing resources. So it's going to be a challenging time to us to deal with load growth, to deal with business growth, we hope, and at the same time reduce carbon. We think this is, if this is can be incorporated into an overall package, that this makes sense as a way for us to do our part within that overall package. say it gives us a platform to operate off of, and it gives you, I think, it's designed to give you an assurance and a commitment to doing our part again with an overall package. So, thank you for the opportunity to talk about our bill, and I'll turn it over to Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, representing the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association, and I will begin my comments by asking that our request of the committee is not to move this bill out of this committee, and I'm going to give you some reasons why we're making that request. The carbon reduction plan that Mr. O'Connor just explained to you was developed during the interim when we were all involved with the WCI discussions. It was anticipated that Oregon would be potentially adopting the WCI cap and trade program. So knowing that we were had a very small carbon footprint, and knowing that cap and trade was probably not an appropriate program for very small utilities, we developed the program that you just heard about. But a cap-and-trade proposal did not garner enough support in the legislature to continue on. However, there continued to be support for climate change legislation, and a discussion group was formed at the request of the chair of the Senate Energy Committee to look at combining several climate change bills into a climate change package, a comprehensive package for Oregon. The consumer-owned utility carbon reduction plan became part of that package discussion. In fact, it has been contained in all four of the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 80. It's also contained in an alternative proposal that is being brought to the legislature by a utility customer industry coalition. The consumer-owned utilities have been very involved and very supportive of climate change package that does not create significant cost and unintended consequences. House Bill 3155 before you today is also included in, as I said, in the industry package. So it's been involved in every single discussion that there's been regarding a climate change package in Oregon, and that is with our full support. With the low carbon footprint of consumer-owned utilities, we would not expect to be singled out for a carbon reduction mandate if Oregon does not approve a climate change package, however, for higher emission sectors. This is a big stretch for very small utilities. Therefore, we would very much appreciate your support of not moving House Bill 3155 out of committee and continuing the efforts to develop a climate change package that includes this alternative approach for low-emission utilities in Oregon. We want to assure you that we will continue to be involved in all of those discussions regarding the climate change package. We will continue to make sure that our proposal is included in those discussions and in the amendments that are being proposed on Senate Bill 80. But we would respectfully ask you not to move 3155 forward as a single issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I want to express my gratitude for the fact that your associations came forward with this bill early in the session. It represents, I think, significant interest and willingness on your part and the part of your members to do some challenging things. I think things that ultimately are good for consumers. As the beneficiary of some of these types of programs through my IOU, I can tell you I love it. But nevertheless, I think there's some hurdles to overcome within your memberships, and I think it's very significant that you came forward, and I really do appreciate that. Let me see if there are questions from members of the committee. Let me ask mine then, which is to just bear down a little bit on the Senate Bill 80 discussions. If we choose not to move forward on this, we'll have to make a decision on moving forward or not with 3155. Are you supportive of the way that this language has been incorporated into Senate Bill 80?
Mr. Chair, if I understand, are you referring to this? If I understand the question. I mean, this language. There have been some minor amendments that we could describe that are in the all versions of both Senate Bill 80 and the Utility Coalition, Industry Coalition legislation that's being worked on over there. If I understood the question.
Let me try asking the question differently. Are there any versions of Senate Bill 80 you've seen that don't work for your association?
Mr. Chair, speaking, I guess, just for my utilities, or the municipal utilities for the moment, we do support the amendments or the utility business coalition draft that is being circulated on the Senate side. Our position is that we support and have worked on federal climate legislation and continue to work on that. We have not supported a state cap and trade. We have not supported what is being referred to around here as a hard cap with mandated reductions to the so-called aspirational goals, the 10% below 1990 levels by 2020. It's a fluid situation. We're working on it. We're trying to be part of it. I would say that, you know, we recognize that this isn't going to come together until there are a lot bigger players than us that need to gel around a compromise package. We do think that's possible.
Okay.
I may still be a little confused
because I thought I heard Sandy say that this bill, or a slight variant on it, was incorporated into all four versions of Senate Bill 80. And I'm wondering if that means then that those four versions of Senate Bill 80 are okay for your members.
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and respond on behalf of my organization. I can tell you that the language in all of the versions of Senate Bill 80 that specifically refer to consumer-owned utilities, we are very comfortable and supportive of. However, there are many other parts of that piece of legislation that deal with creating a council, that deal with investor-owned utilities, that deal with some of the other sectors. We cannot tell you today that we support any of the four versions that have come forward so far. We believe there is still, as Tom said, work left to be done on this. We believe that it's getting closer to a package that will find support in this legislature. But as of today, we cannot tell you that we support the current version of Senate Bill 80 other than what specifically addresses the consumer-owned utilities.
I think that was very clear, and thank you, Sandy, and Tom as well. I appreciate you coming forward with the bill, and look forward to working with you on it or on Senate Bill 80 or something else. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Todd Wynn and North Cheatham, if I have that right. Go ahead, Todd. Unless you arrange something else.
Yeah. No problem.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is North Cheatham. I'm a public interest lobbyist from Hood River, where we are both served by PP&L as well as Hood River Electric Co-op. I'm not affiliated with any other interest group. I look for issues that both reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, particularly coal and petroleum, as well as benefit or affect very large numbers of people. It takes a lot to get me over here. It's a long way for me to drive. But I want to tell you that I very much admire the creative and innovative language in this bill. I realize that consumer-owned utilities cannot join in with the Energy Trust Program because that's a different program altogether. I will tell you that the Energy Trust Program I am quite familiar with. The wind turbine pictured on their website is mine. We put that up in 2004 with Energy Trust assistance. Anyway, the fifth power and conservation plan by the Pacific Northwest Power and Conservation Council identifies 2,800 megawatts of cost-effective conservation potential. Now, that's equivalent to 8 400 megawatt coal plants. But the cost of that saved power is about two-thirds of what coal would be. Consumer-owned utilities, I don't see any reason to oppose this bill because we have both funding provided at 2% of the sales of their utilities billed through their existing rate-paying structure, as well as guidance provided through the Pacific Northwest Power and Conservation Council plan. We even have renewable alternatives for shortfalls from the goals and targets in that bill provided for. Energy consumption is still increasing. In this country, it's increasing about 1.3% per year, despite aggressive and very impressive gains that we have seen on a kilowatts per GDP. We're at 48% more efficient on a power per GDP dollar than we were in 1975. So we make fantastic progress here. But there's so much more to go, and it's still cost effective. What I would urge you to do is to pass this bill, because I don't think any utility should be exempt from a conservation strategy of this nature. We have to do something to curb our carbon emissions. We have to do something to get ourselves as independent as possible from fossil fuels. The cheapest kilowatt of all is that which is not used. This bill is for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wynn.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wynn. I'm an economist working for Cascade Policy Institute, a research organization out of Portland, Oregon. Now, I'm not in support of House Bill 3155, and I got two reasons for that. First, it's adding an extra tax on energy bills in a time of recession, and it'll only further hurt Oregonians. Now, I understand that energy efficiency and conservation programs can help offset some of this tax, but there is a provision in this bill that goes to carbon reduction and avoidance, which means adding more expensive renewable energy onto the grid, which will further increase electricity bills. Now, difficult economic times where low-income Oregonians are having difficulties making ends meet, and also middle-income Oregonians are stretching every dollar earned. Carbon reduction and avoidance is not an immediate problem, but paying electricity bills is. And then the second point is that the bill allows consumer-owned utilities to use a joint agency to implement these programs, which would be a similar agency as the Energy Trust. Senate Bill 1149 established a 3% tax and established the Energy Trust of Oregon. Now, the tax was originally supposed to bring in about $40 million per year in 2002. Now, that's gone, it's excessively expanded to over $120 million now. So now, as we can see, electricity rates rise for consumer-owned utilities. The new tax is going to become larger and larger, a giant green electricity slush fund that's diverted into expensive projects that benefit few at the cost of many. So, because much of this ETO money goes into helping upper-income households and private businesses become more competitive, so it's not really a public purpose charge at all. Now, alternative strategies, you could continue to allow the market to pursue its natural incentive to minimize costs, including energy. Now, as we've said that North Cheatham has already said, the amount of energy per dollar of GDP in Oregon has been declining steadily for 50 years. In fact, energy intensity, energy consumed per unit of GDP, has decreased by 91% over the past 40 years. Now, this is without a 2% charge on your electricity bill. Now, if this bill is going to pass, if you guys want to go through the committee, at least establish a cap on the percentage of a certain absolute amount. As we can see with the ETO funds, it's become on the Oregonian and a couple, I believe the Portland Tribune even made an article about that, where this fund that was supposed to be $40 million grew to $120 million. And that'll certainly happen with this as well when you're picking a 2% percentage out of the total retail electricity sales. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your presentation. Questions? Either
Granger causation. I just want to say that.
Taking me back.
People weren't here then.
Thank you both for your testimony. And with that, I will close the public hearing on 3155. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3249. Let's move there and begin with Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, honored colleagues. Pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Michael Dembro. I'm the representative for House District 45. That's Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And I'm pleased to present to you House Bill 3249, which is an intelligent approach to managing our state forests for the multiple benefits that these lands provide. It attempts to move us beyond rhetoric and false choices regarding present benefit and future benefit. Rather than quantity of lands designated for conservation, it focuses on the quality of those lands. I think we'd all agree that there are portions of the state forests that are appropriate for timber harvesting, and those areas should be logged in a sustainable manner for forest health and ongoing yield. But there are other sections within these forests that need special protection because they contain high-quality fish and wildlife habitat, old-growth forests, sources of drinking water, and because they're fragile and inaccessible. House Bill 3249 applies to state forest lands, common school forest lands, and the Elliott State Forest. It gives the Oregon Board of Forestry the overt authority to designate portions of these lands as natural resource conservation areas. It does not require that land be set aside, but it gives the State Board of Forestry and the State Forester an additional tool for managing forests in an intelligent and sustainable manner. In designating these reserve areas, the Board would be considering a number of benefits that forests provide. For example, access to pristine water sources. The cities of Hillsborough, Beaverton, Forest Grove, and Tualatin draw much of their summer water supply from the Barney Reservoir, which is surrounded almost entirely by the Tillamook State Forest. The residents of those cities need assurances that their access to good water is protected. This bill would allow the sort of protection where needed. The lands would remain open to restoration projects, even though those portions that are eventually designated as conservation areas would remain open to restoration projects, limited harvesting, and low-impact public recreational use. There will be jobs throughout the state forests, sustainable and community-building jobs. These uses will continue to bring many thousands of dollars to the local communities hosting these forests. There are numerous state and county campgrounds, horse camps, boat launching ramps, and hiking trails in the Clatsop, Santiam, and Tillamook State Forests. My family and I have hiked and camped in these forests many times, and I look forward to my grandchildren, and eventually I hope their children and grandchildren, being able to do the same. 22 years ago, the state of Washington set up a similar program to the one envisioned in this bill, and it has a track record for conservation areas within their state forests. You'll hear more about their record of success in the testimony to come. You'll hear more about the specifics of the bill and about its positive potential impact on water, on fisheries, on anglers, on hunters, on our coastal communities, and even its potential for carbon sequestration. Colleagues, this is a bill that is full of common sense, it's revenue neutral, and I urge you to give it your support. And we have several people who are on deck to give you a lot more information, but I would be happy to answer any questions you might have of me.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Boone.
Thank you. I'm going to take you on a little trip to the past.
Thanks.
In 1974, I got married and moved to the coast, very close to Saddle Mountain in Clatsop County. And right away, within 3 months, joined a citizen advisory committee that was put into place or asked to be put into place by DLCD to make a plan for the land use planning. We identified a piece of property, an old growth forest, up on the top of Humbug Mountain that apparently was owned by a private company, or the state, excuse me, and identified that as a conservation zone or whatever it was called at the time. It was to be no touch, no motorized vehicles, no logging unless there was a dangerous tree or something like that. Anyway, and within 2 weeks, that piece of property was traded to a private company, which did, in the clearest sense of the word, clear-cut it completely off. And I guess my point is, if this bill were in place, the State Board of Forestry could do just that. They could trade it with a piece of forest land in our state forest, any of the state forests, trade it to a piece of private land for another piece somewhere else in private land to connect to it to build a bigger piece of conservation land, et cetera. I think you're getting my drift.
Yeah.
So my point is there any limit on the size of these areas, the geographic location of them? Can they be put? I know these are going all together, but I don't want to say follow up 50 times. Would this be possible in this scenario to do this?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I certainly appreciate your concern, and I think if that were to happen, that would be totally contrary to the spirit of this bill.
But the piece of property that was the state property was just as what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that those decisions, if there's anybody from Department of Forestry or the board.
Yeah, well, there might be someone who can address that.
Yeah.
I'd like to think
really
we're in
skilled.
Different times now. And I'm sorry, I'm not going through the chair.
Go for it.
Sorry.
Be natural.
Cannon. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dembrow, the common school forest lands, does that include scattered sections out across Oregon, or are you intending to include in this bill only those which are identified on the map that we were given?
I believe it's just in the identified map, but I'm not certain of that, Representative Benz. And I think there'll probably be someone who follows me who can answer that better.
Thank you for that. Yes. And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. I think there are restrictions on a lot of this land that it has to be used for the common school fund or for the or to raise money for the schools, and I'm not sure how this. Did you work with the folks there to see if this squares with that use, that requirement that the land be used in that fashion?
Yes, Representative Cannon and Representative Benz. You know, I think what we're envisioning here is not anything that would reduce the investments for schools, it would just be a different way that these lands would be used. And so there would be sections where there would be no timber harvest, and then the harvesting would be restricted to other parts. So we don't really foresee a reduction in the amount of money that would be going for schools as a result of this bill.
Right, and I figured you had already worked your way to that point. I was just checking to see how much dialogue you guys had engaged in that kind of a balanced management methodology. Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the Chair will indulge a comment. Representative Denbrough, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think this is an important bill that advances a conversation that recognizes the full spectrum of value that our forests offer to our state, and that sometimes that value is manifest in harvest, and sometimes and often that value is manifest in other ways. And one of the things that we have been poor at, Mr. Chair, in the past is measuring the true value. And if you don't measure it, it doesn't exist often. And we are now better able to do some of these measurements. There are studies that show that that sometimes in some of these parcels, the values that exist from ecosystem services and carbon sinks and recreation and existence value dwarf some of the other values that are in these forests. And I think this is an important economic bill for the state of Oregon that recognizes the resource that we have. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we've had, it was surprising to me, we've had surprisingly few timber-relevant, timber-specific bills in this committee that I can recall. And maybe that's because they're going to other committees. When I was a kid, one of the biggest debates this state had, it's still a big debate, but were debates regarding timber resources, and I'm wondering, and I heard what you had to say, that this would not necessarily increase or decrease harvest levels. Do we have a sense of that this being a northerly force or a southerly force on how much we're harvesting and how much we're versus how much we're protecting and et cetera? I mean, is it? I'm wanting to understand the likely outcomes from the bill as we move forward. I'm really glad you're bringing it, because I won't repeat everything that Representative Colbailey said.
Right. Thank you, Representative Cannon, Representative Smith. The bill itself doesn't designate particular lands for conservation. That's going to be up to the Board of Forestry, and it'll be part of their their overall vision for a statewide plan for forest use, forest protection. And I think actually that's really one of the best features of the bill, is that it doesn't tie their hands. It really leaves it up to the various studies and exigencies that come up, while still having this overall vision of multiple use and full economic benefit relevant to what Representative Bailey was saying.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Representative Denbrough.
Thank you all.
Perhaps you can stick around, or you may have another hearing to attend, but thank you for bringing the bill.
Yes, I'd prefer to go to the forest, but I'll stay.
All right. Thanks very much. We have a few folks who have traveled a good distance to be here. I'd like to start with them and then hear from the Department of Forestry before moving on to others. And just to be clear, we have about 15 people signed up and about 45 minutes left on the scheduled hearing. So I will be using the timer and asking people to keep their testimony to about 3 minutes. So let's begin with Marcia Dennison, Joshua Pritchard, and Aaron Nelson. Oh, no, sorry. He's not 100 miles. Sonia Geiselman. Come on up.
Thank you for respecting the 100-mile rule. They don't all do that, you know. My name is Marcia Dennison of Pacific Rainforest Wildlife Guardians, and I'm all for this bill. It is an excellent bill. Please approve it and send it to the full House. It puts the public back in the public land and assures that native life will have forests of high-quality habitat to prevent the threat of extinction. There is no federal land in northwest Oregon. Tillamook and Clatsop County State Forest are Portland's playground. Places of significance for climate control and water storage are crucial, deserving special care when logging. Reserves would be harvestable and make up a tiny percent of the lands. Logging the last 3% of old growth would be a crime. We must comply with the Endangered Species Act anyway, so there is no harm. Only great benefit to Oregon's people and native wildlife. Also, as to Representative Boone's concerns, reserve, I believe, is defined as held in reserve, which when you hold something, you don't give it to somebody. And an exchange would be challenged legally if there was to be one, because there's a lot of people with strong feelings about this. And also a provision for reserves well written into existing agency rules. There must be board approval also, and it is definitely actionable. And so there is a moderate amount of limit of protection for the reserves from exchange there. And all I can say is pass it, please. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here, for your testimony. Let's hear from other two guests.
Hello. My name is Joshua Pritchard. I'm from Clatsop County. I've spent quite a bit of time conducting citizen surveys, biological surveys, in the forests of the state. And I hope that I reflect a lot of opinions of people who maybe don't necessarily come to the Capitol that often, because it's rather a daunting procedure. I've never been here before for this. So I'm actually here to register my discontent with the fact that this bill wasn't passed years ago. I can't really believe that there's no public input process on state forestry lands. That doesn't make any sense to me. That there's no ability for the option of conservation. I know, you know, there's all this talk about the economy. So why are there more sales going through in the Elliott State Forest right now when timber prices are slumped, where there's no market for this lumber? It's because it's a subsidization of the industrial removal of native forests in Oregon and the conversion of those forests, excuse me, to plantation stands. And people don't come to Oregon for recreation and tourism to play and frolic in the monocrops. They come here because we have something that no other state in this country has, and that is a large part of the 5% of the old growth and the healthy forests that remain. So I think that if people really cared about the economy, they would manage these forests efficiently. You could log less and sell for more. We're not satisfied with how the government has been handling the economy or how the government has been handling the environment. And this will continue to be an issue, regardless of this bill.
That's true.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go
ahead. I'm Sonia, and I'm for it. I have spent a lot of time working with children and working in the big forest.
Yeah, speak up a little.
Hi.
Yeah, you don't have to be super close, but if you speak up a little and give us your full name for the record, please.
Sonia Gieselman, and I'm from Clackamas County, and I'm supporting the bill. I have worked a lot with children through my years, and I've worked a lot in the forest, working to restore lands and working to replant forests that have been damaged or removed. And I believe it's necessary for future generations to be able to see these forests, because it's an important thing for children to be able to go out into the forest and see something that amazing and understand what sort of ecosystem they're actually part of. and what world we're actually in, because without plants and without the forests, we can't survive as a species. We are dependent on this world, and just as the trees are dependent on us passing this bill. And so I believe it's necessary for our children to be able to see this, and so we don't destroy the world and our planet anymore. So I support this bill.
Thank you all for your testimony. You did a great job. Appreciate you being here today. And before you get up, I'll look quickly for questions. Seeing none, thank you. Thanks. Let's hear next from Nancy Hirsch from the department. And I'll go ahead and call up. Well, Nancy, why don't we just hear from you rather than putting you between opposing sides, or maybe that would be appropriate. I don't know, but we'll hear from you, and then I'll get back to panels.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch. I'm the chief of the State Forest Division for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Appreciate having the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 3249. This bill allows the Board of Forestry and the Department of State Lands to designate and manage areas on state forest lands as natural conservation areas, and imposes requirements and restrictions on management of any areas that receive this designation. I want to address 3 points related to this bill. The first one has to do with greatest permanent value management on Board of Forestry state forest lands. Secondly, the authorities described under the bill. And then lastly, I want to talk about the potential effect the bill would have on management of state forests. For greatest permanent value, currently, under Oregon Revised Statute 530, state forests are managed to achieve greatest permanent value to the state. This statute goes on to list a host of permissible uses, including but not limited to protecting lands from fire, insect, disease, and pests, timber sale contracting, fish and wildlife, protection of water supplies, recreation, and the sale of carbon sequestration offsets. The natural conservation areas described in the bill would be designated and managed for a number of purposes noted in the bill: protecting fish and wildlife, drinking water sources and mature and old growth forests, storing carbon, and allowing low impact public uses. These purposes seem to be aligned with the overall purpose of providing greatest permanent value to the state, and in at least some respects are captured in current administrative rules and current management approaches. Second area I wanted to speak to has relates to authorities. This bill applies to common school forest lands and specifically the Elliott State Forest. The State Land Board is charged with setting policy and management direction for common school forest lands under the Article 8 of the Oregon Constitution. So that constitutional authority would prevail over any policy management direction proposed through this statute. The bill also applies to Board of Forestry managed lands, and currently the purpose, scope, and authorities for the Board and the State Forester are described in Oregon Revised Statute 526. The statute provides the Board broad policy discretion. The intent of House Bill 3249 seems to be to provide the Board of Forestry with what we see as an additional tool to manage for greatest permanent value. The Board currently has broad policy authority under Oregon Revised Statute 526 to make such designations. In fact, the Board has exercised this authority through Oregon Administrative Rule by developing and adopting what is known as the Forest Land Management Classification. The Forest Land Management Classification includes direction to the State Forester to classify and manage lands in one of the 3 classes of either general stewardship, focused, and special stewardship. The special stewardship classification is very similar to what's proposed here in the natural resource conservation areas noted in the bill. Lands classified as special stewardship are managed to achieve the goals for a specific resource, making it the priority. Examples of current special stewardship areas include, but are not limited to, portions of riparian areas, rare plant areas, wildlife nesting, special wildlife management areas, campgrounds, and interpretive centers are some of those examples. There's actually 13 different subclasses. Purposes in the bill which are not currently addressed in forest land management classification include protecting mature and old growth forests and storing carbon. The Board could choose to include these in forest land management classification.
Potential effects of the bill. The overall effect of this bill is unknown, as it allows but does not require the board to make special land designations with attendant management restrictions. In summary, the bill seems to have been developed within the spirit of achieving greatest permanent value to the state, provides the board with a statutory authority that they already have and have actively exercised, and overall has an unknown effect because all would depend on how the board would choose to implement the new language. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks very much for your testimony. Questions? Representative Moon.
Thank you. Nancy, so thank you. Are you saying that the board already has the authority to do what the bill proposes for the most part?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, yes. Currently, both through revised statutes as well as specifically the administrative rule known as the Forest Land Management Designation and or Classification.
Thank you.
Nancy, as you know, there was a hearing today on, I believe, House Bill 3072, which would attempt to put some sort of sideboards or some certainty around greatest permanent value, if I understand the bill correctly. Would that help, would that shape the board's designation using the FLMC? Would it, for instance, mean that it would be less likely to designate lands as for special stewardship? I mean, from your testimony, it sounded like that bill, if it became law, and unfortunately we can't consider them together within the same committee, but if that bill became law, it might impact how you use the classification system currently.
I think the language in that bill would still provide the discretion on some level in terms of the administrative rule process that the board could still allocate, as they have done so, with a number of different subclasses in terms of the stewardship classification, because we are still going to be required to classify the forest land base.
Okay, I'll just spend another moment on this, and this is really helpful. In your written testimony, you say that the board could designate lands as special stewardship areas for the purpose of, for instance, protecting mature old growth forests and storing carbon under the FLMC. They could do that as long as it was in the overall context of providing the greatest permanent value to the state. I wonder if House Bill 3072 passed, would the analysis change related to the designation of lands as special stewardship areas? Would, for instance, it become, would you have to have different kinds of considerations or a different kind of conversation about designating lands as special stewardship areas?
I think in terms of the classification itself, the system, the board would certainly may choose to revisit those administrative rules and see if they are still aligned with new language in regards to greatest permanent value. At the same time, there's a lot of discretion and policy choice there for the board.
Great. Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the driving influence, just as Representative Boone mentioned, is the permanency that people want in these special places. And the question I ask is, does the current framework of regulation allow the board to lock a part of the forest, the school lands, up so that it stays exactly the same, assuming it doesn't burn down? Or do they have to revisit that area with some sort of higher review? That is, oh, gee, it's all big timber now. We need to log it. Thus destroying a special place that people become accustomed to seeing over their lives. Which is it? I'm trying to get at what's that important element that currently the board must take into account before it makes a decision?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, in the broader context of achieving greatest permanent value, the administrative rule recognizes that active management is to be applied across these state forest lands. Having said that, there are legal requirements that the state must comply with, like Forest Practices Protection Act, as well as policy choices that the board approves through their forest management planning process. So the nature of permanency, we do not currently designate anything into that category. I would suggest, though, that the bill itself does not specify that language specifically at this point in time. It basically gives the board the authority to designate these areas, and then it doesn't exactly say what type of specific management activities may or may not occur. It does identify some that could occur.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy. This was helpful. We have a number of folks still to hear from today, but you'll probably be getting a follow-up from some of us offline. Thank you. Tim Josie, Tom Wolf, Jeff Hickman. Hi. Mr. Josie, you want
to
start us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tim Josie, Tillamook County Commissioner, Chair of the Forest Trust Land Counties, and former legislator. The only one up here that used to be a legislator when I was here is Representative Jensen. How you doing, Bob?
Good.
And Debbie worked with me, and I'm a victim of term limits. I'm also the class of...
Or the beneficiary of them.
That's a correct statement. I used to say that I was a victim of term limits, and then I found out that being a county commissioner was pretty meaningful work, and so now I say that I'm a beneficiary of term limits. However, I will say that I think the state was a victim of term limits. That term limits does not serve the state well, and I'm really glad to see that that law was overturned and the people didn't vote for it the second time around. So that was a bad piece of legislation. Well, unfortunately, you know, we're going to have to oppose this bill. I don't think that comes as any surprise to you. What you need to know is that these lands have certain restrictions that go back some 70 years. These lands were deeded to the state to be managed on behalf of the counties. And we've had to exercise our rights a couple of times. The first time was the Crabtree case, and this was, I'll get the exact date here in a minute, in 1984. This was when the Oregon legislature, in their wisdom, they had their eyes on Crabtree Valley in Linn County, and it belonged to Willamette Industries, and they wanted to create a state park, and so they had to come up with a land swap, and so they thought they'd take some state forest lands and do that, and they actually started the process, and they asked, the bill actually said that ODOT was to be the arbitrator to consummate the deal, and the deal never happened. As soon as the legislature adjourned and the bill became law, we sued and we won. And Mr. Chair, I'm just going to read a little snippet from Judge Ertzgard, and I'll go on to Judge Behrens with another case. I didn't make extra copies, but I've got these three legal opinions. I'd be more than happy to let you have those, and you can share those with the committee so that you can get a little more grounded on some of the legal history. I think they do a pretty good job. But Judge Ertzgard says, he said, a trust relationship exists between the parties. The state has a fiduciary responsibility to its partners, which are in the nature of a trustee obligation. The second time we had to exercise our rights in court was with the Forest Development Fund case. And this was in 2005, and the Oregon legislature was in big trouble financially, just like they are now, only you're much worse now. And the legislature decided to take $10 million from the Forest Development Fund. This is the share of state timber receipts that the Oregon Department of Forestry uses to manage these lands on our behalf.
Mr. Josie, if you could wrap it up here very briefly.
So, anyway, we sued and we won, and the judge said a 70-year history exists where all actions taken by the state have been with the consent of the counties. The statutory scheme envisions management of the forest lands to achieve the highest return to the counties. Now, if this bill passes, and if the Board of Forestry exercises their rights and creates these natural resource areas, there are a couple of areas in this bill that cause us a great deal of concern. And the first one is that it creates a NEPA process for harvesting timber in these natural resource lands. The NEPA process is something that we don't have in Oregon. The NEPA process is what has effectively closed down our federal forest lands because it allows citizens' lawsuits, and that's a tool that's not existing today. And then secondly, it creates eliminates road construction in these areas. And so I don't think that if this bill passes, I don't think the Board of Forestry would actually exercise this right. But if they did, we'd have to go back to court again and to exercise our rights. And so for that reason, we're opposing the bill.
Thank you for your testimony and for being here today. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Limited. We do support this bill. We think that this gives a good tool to the Board of Forestry to protect special areas. One area that I can think of just off the top of my head is Salmonberry River, which is many parts of that flow through the Tillamook-Clatsop State Forest. It is a wonderful place. It is has in it the largest run of wild steelhead, all wild steelhead in on the coast. Practically, has never had, as far as I know, hatchery fish stocked in there, and there are legends of steelhead caught up there that go over 20 pounds. It's a very special place, and I'd like to think that with this, if this bill is passed, that it could provide the Board of Forestry with methods to protect places like this. There are many other places. We need these a rule like this so that areas like this could be protected for the fish, but also for the fishermen. Every year, I go up into there and very seldom catch any of those steelhead, but get to enjoy a special place that is beautiful. It is wild, and with the thought that maybe I might actually be lucky enough to catch one of those large steelhead. Secondly, speaking as a dweller of the city of Hillsboro, which has grown in from 30,000 to 90,000 in a short period of 15 years since I've been there, and is projected to hit 130,000 by the year 2020. Many of the streams that flow out of the Tillamook Forest go into Barney and go into Hague Lake and are the drinking sources for the city of Hillsboro. And I'd like to think that this bill would provide extra sources of protection for the drinking water that Hillsboro, like many other cities, so desperately needs. We are looking at a huge jump in population in Washington County. In fact, they predict by the year 2030, Washington County will have more people than Multnomah County. So looking at a way that protects water for a large part of Washington County is vitally needed. So therefore, both as a member of a conservation group and as a dweller in the city of Hillsboro, I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Hello. My name is Jeff Hickman. I've been a full-time fishing guide in Oregon for the last 7 years, and I am here today to represent the hunters and fishermen with the Sierra Club. I'm here to support House Bill 3249, and thought I wouldn't bore you guys with some, you know, telling you why you need to protect these crucial areas, but I thought maybe I'd just share a little story with you guys. So there was a very special place in my heart, a river like no other. This river was home to some of the healthiest numbers of large native steelhead around. These fish evolved to be big and strong. They had to be. Only the biggest and the strongest fish of the run could leap the numerous large waterfalls to make it to the prime spawning grounds to pass along their superior genes. The river itself was more beautiful than you can imagine. Steep canyon walls giving way to deep emerald green pools separated by whitewater chutes and fierce rapids. The canyon walls were covered in a canopy of green, old growth snags, moss-covered cliffs, lush ferns, and an abundance of wildlife. When you entered this canyon, it felt as though you had taken a step back into time. You could hike along the railroad tracks that paralleled the river, and you could get lost in your strides on the railroad ties and forget about how far you had gone because you were so excited about what around each bend you would find. The railroad bed also provided a great platform for viewing the river and spotting the big steelhead that laid in there, and also later in the season watching them spawn. This is right here in Oregon. It's the Sanbury River, a tributary to the Nehalem. Unfortunately, right now this is all part of the past. The fierce storms that the winter before last delivered to the North Coast dropped too much rain on that canyon for it to handle, and I think as a result of the clear cutting on the ridgetop above and outdated culverts, all of the gullies and small tributary streams that fed into the Sanbury had huge detrimental landslides that changed the ultimate course of the river. I was just in there a couple of months back to view it, and it's incredibly difficult to get around in there, and it's almost like there's just been bombs dropped all over in the canyon. You can't get around because all the landslides and everything, and the whole nature's changed. The pools have all filled in, and the whole river has been scoured out, and it no longer do you have nice holding spawning areas, but you have more of just a flume of fast current making its way out of there. The reason I wanted to share this story with you is because I think if the Board of Forestry has the power to designate special places like this for conservation, then we can maybe avoid things like this from happening in other special places and allow a special place like this to repair itself and come back to what it once was. The Board of Forestry may already have the right to designate these areas of conservation. Why not pass this bill and affirm that power that they have? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well. Any questions? Thank you all. We'll hear next from Bob Van Dyke, Aaron Nelson, and it might be Samantha Chirillo or Chirillo. And while they're coming up, I should say this bill is something represents something of coming full circle for me. My first experience as an adult in the Oregon State Capitol was involved taking school children here to testify on a bill that related to forest practices in our state forests. So that was back in 2003, and we signed up on the sheet and came forward to testify. I think the chair gave my students about 30 seconds each. There were three of them, and then cut them off. It was within a Senate committee. But it's certainly does feel like full circle to be hearing this bill now. In any order. Start with.
Some materials in the
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, my name is Aaron Nelson. I'm from Lane County, and I'm here to advocate this bill. Two days ago, I had the privilege of being a guest in the Elliott State Forest, and I learned that half of it has already been converted into industrial fiber farms. So a large portion has already been industrialized. It serves no purpose for habitat that the native forests do. And which leads me to say that half of the forest still remains is native forest, where it's not technically considered old growth, I learned, but it's 140 years old, and there's some trees in there that are 6 feet wide. So it has all the characteristics of an old growth forest, and it was a very beautiful place to visit. I had the privilege of witnessing an osprey catch a fish out of a lake in front of me, and yeah, it was just very magical, which I don't think they, you know, put magic into their economic, you know, analysis of these places, but I just want to say that I think these places have a right to exist just in their nature. So I've spent some times in the woods as a wildland firefighter, and I can say I have a conflict of interest here because I know that if we go in and clear cut these native forests and replant them with timber plantations that are monocrops, it'll actually improve my likelihood of getting work because I don't get paid unless there's fires out there. But I can say that I, as well as many of my coworkers, would rather see these places exist than get more work tromping around in monocrops of trees that are too thick to get to very easily and then watch them burn up into the sky. And I believe that these monocrops and their increase in existence has caused the mega fires that we've witnessed sprout up recently in the history of wildfire much more frequently. So as we all know, I think old native forests are much more fire resistant. Of course, they're much more spacious in their interior, and they might light on fire, but it's usually just the creeping fires that go through in the lower spaces and not so much up in the canopies of the trees. So, I mean, personally, I'd like to see a moratorium on all cutting of native forest in the state. But this bill doesn't provide for that, but it does move in the direction of allowing for some more conservation to take place, so therefore I'm here advocating it. And, I'm also speaking on behalf of many of the youth in Eugene. So there's a lot of people that wanted to be here today who wanted to speak, but, you know, they have other obligations, and not everyone has a whole lot of faith in the process either of suggesting things to Democratic leaders. So I'm going out on a limb and taking up some of my time and hope that you all listen to me. So thank you.
Appreciate your willingness to do that and your faith in the process, and thank you for being here.
Chair, committee members, my name is Bob Van Dyke, and I work for a group called the Wild Salmon Center. It's located in Portland, Oregon, and our mission is to preserve the strongest wild salmon stocks on the whole Pacific Rim. I also live in Forest Grove, and I'm a professor at Pacific University there. A few thoughts for you today. We support this bill. We think it's a good bill. We've been very deeply involved in forest management for many years, forest management decision-making. I've been attending Board of Forestry meetings for about 10 years now, mostly on my own time, but more recently for the Wild Salmon Center. So putting things in context a bit, I passed some maps out there I'd like to call your attention to. The first one has the big green area on it. Looks like this. I didn't have enough for all of you, but I hope you'll share. The point I'd like to make with this map is you'll see the green area there is public land. That's the state land, Tillamook and Clatsop Forest. And I think it shows that some of the only public land in the whole North Coast is state land. So there's a large urban population directly adjacent to those state forests. There's not a lot of federal land up there. The second map I'd like to call your attention to is this one with all the colors in it. And the colors in this map, the red stands for clear cuts in the last 40 years, and the orange is clear cuts that are predicted on state land for the next 40 years. So these, in under the current department recommendation, so these management, this context gives us a lot of concern about this area. The third map is a zoom in on the other, and it shows the Wilson River watershed, which is what Highway 6 goes over to the coast to Tillamook. And this shows the 50-year timber harvest clear cuts under the current recommendation put forward. It's got the last 8 years, and then it goes forward for 40 years. So there's some context for you. I'd like to respond and add some things to some speakers brought up today. First, the concern about locking up the lands. Washington State has a similar program. They manage 5.6 million acres, and 2% of those acres they've designated as special conservation areas. So I'm certainly not envisaging some kind of widespread, you know, half the forest locked up or something. Secondly, regarding the board's authority, and I think this is important, I think the board does legally have authority to do something like this. There is a forest land management classification that Ms. Hirsch mentioned, but I'd like to call your attention to the actual language of it. It's on the second page of my testimony. The way that system works is the district forester recommends to the state forester places for protection. There's a presumption that there'll be silviculture on all those areas unless a special exception is made. This material never goes to the board for a decision. This is a lower departmental level process. It can be changed by the state forester. Right now it's being changed. It's open for comment. The Board of Forestry isn't going to weigh in on that. So there is a mechanism in law for them to protect areas, but I think this says, Board of Forestry, we want you to take the lead in making these kinds of designations. Lastly, I guess I'd like to say that, two brief things. I'd support dropping that environmental impact statement language. I don't think that's needed in the bill. I think the bill could actually be improved without that. Regarding the legal issue that Mr. Josie brought up, I just say that that's not a settled matter. The latest Attorney General opinion in 2006 says there is no fiduciary responsibility by the board to the county, so I just like to say that's not settled. Lastly, I guess I'd like to say that I think this would be good for the board to do. The board is often seen as a timber-centered board, and I think it would help them to have this in their arsenal and to exercise this authority, even in a modest way. It would help the department think more about conservation. It would help the reputation of the board as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. One more. Yes, go ahead.
Samantha Cirillo from Lane County. I'm only representing myself, but I am a member of Cascadia Rising Tide, which has a public forest defense campaign. And coming and talking to you today in support of 3249 is a critical part of our work in protecting our public forests. I organized youth to lobby on forest issues here on March 31st, one of them being the House Resolution 3, which was pro-whopper. So if any of you helped to effectively kill that resolution, I thank you very much for that. Our campaign all through the fall was urging the governor to oppose that that terrible Bush and BLM plan. I organized the hike to the Elliott State Forest on Sunday, and along with the outdoor program at the U of O, and we had the best and the brightest attending with us, including Francis Etherington, Conservation Director for UMCO Watersheds, and Roy Keane, a very well-known and respected forester, forest consultant. And when we were driving in, it was just like ridge upon ridge of clear cuts, of some of them burned, just wasteland. And it appeared that there was more clear cut than conserved, intact forest. And they, Francis and Roy confirmed that for us, that there's essentially like a 2-to-1, destruction of the biggest and best parcels of forest left in the Elliott versus conservation of what's left. If we destroy Oregon's mature and old-growth forest, the game of life is over. So if all other economic considerations really take a back seat, in my opinion. Our state forests are coastal. They have sensitive riparian areas. They're really the best for storing carbon because they can grow fast. They have the wettest climate. And being that we might not see a serious addressing of climate change in this legislative session from SB 80, it's very critical that we use opportunities like allowing protection of mature and old-growth forests for carbon storage to happen, so that we can really address that crisis. And for me, keeping youth involved in lobbying, because really a lot of what I do is organize youth to come lobby. It's their first time. And to keep them involved in the democratic process really requires that you not only listen to us, but give great consideration to how your decision impacts our future. And about the public involvement process, I just wanted to say that it doesn't specify what that process is. I agree that NEPA has problems, but this bill doesn't specify the process, so there's a lot of flexibility as with the rest of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And appreciate the good testimony from all quarters. Thank you. Let's move on to our last, or just about our last, group. Chris Jarmer, Ivan Molesky, Bob Olson, and Dave Moskowitz, you're sort of on deck.
Mr. Chair, members, Chris Jarmer, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm here to oppose this House Bill 3249. You heard Tim Josie, Commissioner Josie, talk about the revenue impacts, and I tend to agree. I think this bill is in opposition to the land's main purpose, which is on the Common School Fund land side, generate revenue for the Common School Fund. and the Board of Forestry lands for revenue for the county. So I think this bill fundamentally is contrary to that main purpose. I do understand that some people don't buy that argument, so I'm going to try a different argument on you today. If you choose to go forward, and these lands, these areas are considered important and worth protecting, I'd ask that you find a mechanism for all of the state of Oregon's citizens to share in the cost, because the way it's set now, that won't happen. The cost will be unequally borne by the areas in which they exist. And to illustrate my point, timber sales generate revenue for individual taxing districts, libraries, police, fire, and any lands that are designated within their boundaries will be simply removed from their base. So their revenues will go down in the future. I don't think there's any question. Representative Smith asked if harvest levels would go down. I think that's clearly the case. Timber revenue would go down, and it would be disproportionately borne by the local taxing districts within those counties that they exist. So if it's important that this go forward, I'd ask that you find a way to more equally distribute that burden of cost across the state. So with that, I'd stop and answer any questions. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks. Let's hear from one of our other panelists. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molusky with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. And first of all, I want to thank, you for having this hearing. I'd like to thank Representative Dembrow for bringing this interesting idea forward. I'd like to thank the Board of, or the Department of Forestry for coming today and verifying that this does not come into conflict with the greatest permanent value as it's implemented on our state forests. I think that's an important note. You know, you could easily draft a forest bill that would draw opposition from the Department of Forestry, and I think it's significant that they're essentially neutral and seeing that there are ways they can really work with this. The Sierra Club's members have a strong interest in state forest lands and the values that they produce. I wanted to kind of flag that my colleague, Jeff Hickman, earlier, he's sort of downplaying. He is a really big fishing guide and has come on board of the Sierra Club to work with our hunters and anglers who are members. A significant portion of our members do hunt and fish. And I know he'd rather be out fishing today, but I dragged him to this hearing. There's just a lot of values that we associate with these state forests that are, I think, benefit not just Sierra Club members but citizens across the state. Ultimately, what this bill does is it creates a new tool, as we've talked about, for the Board of Forestry to conserve important values on state lands. With increasing population, threats of climate change, our state forests are steadily actually increasing their value in terms of recreation, clean water, opportunities for hunting and fishing, and for carbon storage. These values are not mutually exclusive from timber production on our state forests, and it can in fact be compatible within the multiple use context, as the department mentioned, but not always on the same acreage. And I think that's important to remember. There are acres that we are already looking at that are already popular recreational areas that already may have some sort of interim protection for endangered fish and whatnot. And I think that this bill kind of acknowledges that and tries to really highlight that. The designation of these natural resource conservation areas by the board, as outlined in this bill, will create a public forum to have the discussion of which areas deserve protection from logging impacts. It's going to include municipal watersheds, and I'm not going to do the laundry list of all the things that are in the bill. We expect that the board, as they do with many issues, to undertake a public process with testimony from all sides when considering any such area. The board is a diverse group, I'd like to point out, populated by multiple individuals with a direct interest in the forest products industry and the wood products unions. We do not expect them to utilize this tool to set aside large areas of state forests unless there was broad public support or some other overwhelming public interest in such an action. In fact, one critique I've heard about this bill is that it doesn't flat out require the board to designate a set of areas. That being said, we think it's a very important step to allow them to do this and move us forward to have this conversation. It's also important to remember that state forests are just 3% of the state's acreage as compared to industrial timberlands or federal forests, which I think are somewhere in the 50 to 60% of the state. Lastly, I'd like to say that, you know, in 1987, Washington State took a similar legislative action. Ultimately, out of their 5.6 million, I believe it is, of state lands, acres of state lands, they protected about 2%. And what they've done is they've used it to really draw attention to the positive values associated with their state forests. They've really highlighted it. I've included at the back of my testimony a page that sort of describes their program. You know, it's got a link to their website. And I think it's a real opportunity to sort of, part of why we want to flag this is not just some sort of administrative thing that some department staffers may designate it, but something that comes to the board level that really can highlight some of these positive areas and attract people and attract attention to our state forests in a way that I think brings out the positive, because we know there's going to be timber harvest on state lands, but I think sometimes the department and the board have a hard time telling their story, and this would be a way for them to do that. Lastly, I just want to say, I'll wrap up, and I was hoping Representative Barnhart would be here to hear this part of the testimony. In my few years of lobbying on forest issues here in the legislature, I know there's a lot of interest in the state becoming more involved in federal lands management issues. I think that this type of thing really would bring credibility to the board and the department. If they do want to become more involved with federal lands, it's much more of a conservation focus on those lands. I think this type of thing could really just add to that credibility and help them look really good in that context. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Chair Cannon, committee members, thank you very much. Bob Olson with today for Northwest Steelheaders. I'll be brief because I'm following other proponents who have made a very strong case. But I did want to reinforce the fact that Steelheaders care about healthy watersheds, and we value the long-term security of these special places, and this bill contributes greatly to that goal. It also elevates the importance of conservation areas within our communities that are close to these state forests. In particular, we care about wildlife habitat, and we also enjoy or participate in providing educational opportunities to young people, and this would be a part of that program, too. 3249 underscores the importance of placing a conservation emphasis on small pieces of prime public land, and that's very important. We appreciate you giving this matter attention.
Thank you. Mr. Moskowitz, you want to sub in here for somebody, anybody, a couple of people. Now they're running, see, no more questions. Go ahead, Dave.
We're trying to follow the beavers, I guess. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, here today on behalf of the Native Fish Society. I was there, Chair Cannon, when you were had your students.
Yep.
And a matter of fact, I had a call today from that chair who was fairly rude to your...
Did he apologize?
I just left a message, but I'm going to tell him that this came up today because that has stuck with me to this day, the treatment that you received, that your students received. But anyway, yes, it's nice to be talking about this today. One of the things I'd like to point out and reinforce the points that Representative Bailey made earlier, there are strong environmental and economic benefits that come from managing clean water, carbon sequestration, fish and wildlife. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has not done a rigorous and economic analysis of all the benefits that come from managing these lands for the public. And in fact, the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, or OFRI, does have an economic report which talks about the value of timber. And in that report, in a very short section, they give it very short script, but they say, indeed, the value, the non-timber values easily will outweigh the timber values on this land, but they're very difficult to quantify. That's what they said. It's time for the state to do a rigorous environment economic analysis of the benefits from leaving trees standing, because I think we can, and the reason we need to do that is not just for the people who come to the forest to play, but we need to do it for the communities like Tillamook and Bay City and Garibaldi that are out there in the community who are expecting these forests to provide revenues for their counties. And that's why we need to do that kind of analysis. Now, this bill, it's a little far from this bill, but this is an important element that the board, it gives the board a very nice tool to begin to provide for other values from these forests. I would like to say that in line 21, we should add that the State Board of Forestry may designate by rule areas for this, and I think then that could deal with the section on the back page, lines 13 and 14, where we talk about an environmental impact statement. Those are kind of fighting words for a lot of reasons, and maybe we don't need those. But if the state designated these areas by rule, that would have the APA would require a comment period, so the public could be involved in that process. There's not a triggering mechanism really here, and I suppose one could be added, or you could leave it to the APA, where someone could simply petition the board to engage in this kind of designation. We think that would be, it'd be something to think about whether there should be a specific mechanism. And finally, I just want to say I've been involved in dealing with these state forests for a long time, and back in In 2003, when the plan was first implemented, the department did designate salmon anchor habitats, which are still being managed right now. There's about 13 of them. We had proposed for about 23 of them, but these are special places, and that's the important part of this forest. Is the current plan tries to sort of manage for multi-uses every single acre, and some acres are more important for fish or clean water or cultural reasons than other areas. Some areas are probably proper for timber harvest. And this gives voice to designating those areas specifically for the non-timber uses. And that's why the Native Fish Society supports this bill. And we really appreciate your patience. And thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Smith, looks like you caught one.
I think it's an interesting discussion, and it is, I mean, it goes to the heart of who we are as a state, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic. It's sort of what defines us, right? And that this is, you know, this state is special, not just because of the lines that go around it, but because of the bounty provided by Almighty God, right, as translated through the natural environment, and not limited to that, and the fact that most of the European human impact that made it this state and called it something beyond what Native Americans called it was built on timber harvesting, and the and trying to figure out how, that's not a dirty little secret of the history of the state, that's why we have this building, for instance, and trying to find sort of the balanced way of thinking about that is it is risen and fallen many of political conversation greater than any I will ever participate in over the last many years. And I'm sort of wondering, so that's my prelude. I say it for the record, and also for the many committee members who still remain. But also as the preface to my question, which is, are there win-win possibilities? Fallen timber value versus other types of value, and I appreciate very much you're defining it not as merely cutting trees versus an environmental impact, but also understanding their economic benefits other than the timber harvesting. But are there win-win opportunities, are there compromise opportunities within even just timber harvesting through smarter management, or have we already figured all that out, you know, with the many conversations I had in the years? I mean, really trying to get up to speed with the current state of the art in sustainable logging, et cetera. You know, is this merely giving government an additional tool to pick winners or losers, or are there win-win chances here? And I'm really asking you to kind of educate me.
That Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, that's an excellent question, and I think that it's been an interesting day because in the morning we talked about a bill that would increase the harvest on this forest. At lunchtime, Representative Reed talked about salmon fishing between commercial fishermen and sport fishermen, and here we are talking about forests again. And so we're tackling some of the most intractable issues in the state, and I do really appreciate the search for a win-win. All of us have some baggage, and I think Commissioner Josie's not here, but you know we've had our battles. I think there's a lack of trust in some cases to actually have that conversation. But I worked for the Wild Salmon Center for 6 years on this issue, just about exclusively, and I do believe there are win-wins out there, win-wins for the environment, for the fish, for the people who depend on them all up and down the coast, for the communities there. I think these are resilient communities. The Tillamook and Clatsop County, timber is a big issue, or big part of the economy. I think it always will be. But there are it is a diverse economy there with tourism and with fishing. And I think there is that room. So I hope that gives you, as new to this issue, I hope it gives you some reason to think that you can, that we can look at this differently. And I think this bill is a very modest start. And I think that I'm very pleased that the Department of Forestry sees it as a possible, as something they can do within their statutory limits. And I'm very pleased to see that testimony. And we hope that maybe this is a little crack in that intractable debate.
Thank you very much, and appreciate the folks who stayed right up until the end, and all the people who came to testify on this bill who waited patiently while we worked our others. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3249 and close the Committee on Environment and Water.